Testing, testing. Hello.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I thought for a minute there I was going to have to be a relative to get introduced.
You couldn't do any better.
I welcome this opportunity now to get the meeting back on a nonpartisan basis. No, I'm very grateful. I always get self-conscious. Being introduced and hearing things that are said that I don't deserve, but that I feel guilty because I enjoy hearing them so much. I suppose I'd have to explain my presence here, but I hope that I wouldn't have to explain it on the basis of the fellow that introduced or that entered his mule in the Kentucky Derby. Somebody asked him, said, "You don't think the mule's got a chance to win, do you?" He says, "No, but I figure the association will do him good." I've been protesting the growth of government and the power of government for a number of years. And I have expressed a concern along the mashed potato trail. As a matter of fact, I've told some of you that I've been on that trail so long now that if Nancy makes a mistake and serves a hard roll at home, I automatically just get up and say, "Mr. Toastmaster." But I've expressed a concern lest the permanent structure of government become so big as to be virtually beyond the control of Congress. And lest this permanent structure, which goes on regardless of the course an election may take, might take a hand in formulating national policy. During these years, I've seen some interesting developments. Several years ago, when I would suggest the danger that was inherent in possible government control in so many federal helpful hands, I was met with a vehement denial that such a thing could not take place, that we could have federal aid at almost every level and of every type, and there would be no risk of federal government control. Before long, there was a subtle change. I was still preaching the same sermon, but some of the same people who had said there was no danger of this kind were now saying, "What's wrong with federal control?" And all of us have recently heard people high in the upper echelons of government ask us, "Are you afraid of your own government?" Well, to tell you the truth, I am. And I think all of us should be. Not because of a particular administration, but we should always be fearful of the institution of government itself. This was the admonition of the founding fathers time after time, that government, any government tends to grow, that it takes on an increase in power and size until eventually freedom is lost, whether we like to admit it or not. What they tried to tell us a couple of hundred years ago in this country was only government is capable of tyranny. These warnings have come down from the founding fathers, from Jefferson, from Madison. Woodrow Wilson put it succinctly in one line when he said, "The history of the freedom of man, the liberty of man, is the history of the limitation of government, not the growth of it." And a young senator a few years ago said, "The scarlet thread running through the thoughts and actions of people all over the world is the delegation of a great number of vital problems to the all-absorbing Leviathan, the state." Every time that we try to lift a problem to the government, to the same extent, we are sacrificing the liberty of the people. And this was no wild-eyed extremist. This was a young senator named John Fitzgerald Kennedy, voicing perhaps what had been expressed by the great French philosopher Bastiat 100 years ago when he said, "The state is the great fictitious entity by which everyone seeks to live at the expense of everyone else." Now, I realize this is a controversial subject, but if we were going to avoid controversial subjects completely, we wouldn't be able to talk at all. Of course, this gets very controversial with an election year facing us. People are apt to read into whatever remarks you make some kind of partisan loyalty. When I say controversy is inherent in everything, there was a man knocked at a door one day, and a small boy answered, and the man asked him, he said, "Is your father home?" And the kid said, "No." And he says, "Your mother home?" And the kid said, "No." And finally, the man, a little nonplussed, said, well, son, I happen to be your uncle on your father's side. And the kid said, well, I guess you can come in, but I'll tell you right now, you're sure as hell on the wrong side. Now, we can view the so-called conservative today as a reactionary, opposed to all change and progress. Likewise, the liberal is a bleeding heart who'd sacrifice all freedom to satisfy the material needs of the less fortunate. And I'm sure that there are people among us who fit both these or either one of these descriptions. But I'm sure also that the majority, and I hope the majority, would be found on some ground where, without bitterness, we could debate and discuss what price we're willing to pay in freedom and the alteration of our traditional social form for material security. Now, I freely admit to alarm at the extent to which such debate has been reduced by hostile charge and countercharge. Because so much of government growth has been concerned with welfare problems, those who question the omnipotence of the welfare state are all too often accused of lacking in humanity, that they're not opposed to the particular program that's been suggested. They are opposed to the humanitarian goal. Nowhere was this more evident than in the controversy over the recent adoption of the Medicare legislation. This is a pretty good example of how this debate could be distorted. Somehow, opposition to this bill segued into a charge, not that one was opposed to Medicare as a piece of legislation, but the opponents were against medical care for the aged. Now, this distorted the position of those, and I include myself, who opposed this bill for one reason, because it did not and does not meet the problems of those elderly who cannot provide medical treatment for themselves. The benefits of this legislation are limited to subsidizing hospitalization for 90 days and some nursing home service and a few fringe services. And they have made these available even to multimillionaires. Those who are really unable to afford the doctor or medication when they need it are still without any provision for those costs. Well, I'm sure, of course, that the proponents of this legislation had in mind expanding it as election year followed election year until eventually they would have complete nationalization, which was their original goal, or as some prefer to call it, socialization of medicine. In spite of the fact that other countries that have preceded us in this line are now bitterly critical in almost every instance of the high cost and the low quality of their own medicine. And one major nation in Europe has already confessed that in this type of program, it has reached bankruptcy. Now, to counter the charge that this means opposition to providing needed medical care, let me state my own position, and I believe that it represents the position of any responsible citizen. I don't think anyone in a country such as ours should be denied medical care because of a lack of funds. And I think that applies regardless of any age classifications. I believe that public funds, because there is a legitimate area of cooperation between the private sector and government, public aid, I believe that public funds could be used to provide premiums for health and medical insurance for those people of demonstrable need, so that they could have an insurance policy fitting their particular family problems and could choose a doctor or a hospital with no embarrassment as to whether public funds provided that insurance policy. Right now, we have 10 months to go before Medicare takes effect. What are the people supposed to do that require help now in this 10-month period? Take an aspirin and wait? The truth is that under the Kerr-Mills bill, in a number of states such as our own that have adopted this, had the state administrations not been waiting for this compulsory government program, they could have put such a program as I have just mentioned into effect in all these last several years for all of the people over 65. And we could have had a chance to see whether there was not an alternative to this all-out compulsory program, which has so many weaknesses, failings, and so much inherent danger. But We live in a schizophrenic world, here in this nation at least. We live in unprecedented ease and prosperity, but I find it hard to accept that we're on a broad highway leading ever onward and upward. I'm sure there are many of us that are troubled by a suspicion that we're experiencing the exhilaration of a toboggan ride and we don't know what's around the next bend. 2 months ago, we ended the fiscal year, and Congress was asked to raise the debt limit for the 7th time in 5 years. Our gold supply is so diminished there is fear for the solvency of our currency. The cost of living, particularly in foodstuffs, has reached an all-time high. But the farmer who produces those foodstuffs is receiving the lowest percentage of the market basket dollar that he has ever received. We pretend we're at peace, but a few Americans die each day. And I'm sure for them it's been total war. We move toward the welfare state with an unprecedented federalization of American life. Subsidies proliferate and security becomes so all-important as to override self-reliance and self-respect and even simple morality. And now serious discussion is given at the higher reaches of government to the idea that a central authority should make sure that the need to work is divorced from income, and that there should be guaranteed income for all, regardless of whether they make any contribution to their own welfare or to society. De Tocqueville, another French philosopher, also 100 years ago, warned that such a government would, quote, cover the face of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, and thus the will of man is not shattered, but softened and guided until the nation is reduced to a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which government is the shepherd. Freedom is very fragile. Mankind has only known a few moments of freedom in all his history. And most of those moments have taken place in this country, under this system of constitutional government and under an economic system based on free enterprise and capitalism. Now, however, our limited government with its decentralized powers has given way to planners who've laid an increasingly heavy hand in every facet of our lives. Sometimes when I look at the efforts of these planners and the diverse directions they follow, I think if all of them were laid end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion. We once had a system of checks and balances. Well, we've got plenty of checks, but someplace along the line, we've lost our balance. If we ever decide we need a new revolution, I hope we keep one line from the old. That sentence, "He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance." It only takes 12 doctors for every 10,000 people in the United States to keep us well and healthy. It only takes 40 oil station attendants and mechanics for every 10,000 to keep our cars running on the highways. But it takes 130 federal employees for every 10,000 to administer the affairs of state. Federal employees outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including our own. And where California is concerned, that's not easy. The threat of even more regulation and at times outright takeover looms ever larger. Louis Levine, the United States Director of Employment, backed by a $200 million budget, says the ultimate goal is to make the United States Employment Service the manpower agency for the entire nation, that there will no longer be any need for private employment agencies. And thus we can foresee a day, perhaps, when government will be dictating who is employed and where they will be employed and what it takes to get a job. Every businessman could tell his own story of harassment. I have one that I've enjoyed telling for about a year because about a year ago this happened. The Federal Power Commission submitted a questionnaire to the natural gas producers. It weighs 10 pounds. It's 428 pages, and each page is 2 feet long. There's room on each page for hundreds of entries. They have to fill it out in quadruplicate. One firm has estimated it'll take 17,000 accountant man hours to complete this questionnaire. The Power Commission says that it has to have it to decide whether they're charging the right price for gas. Are we safe in our books and our records, with the post office now turning over letters, as a congressional committee discovered, to the Internal Revenue Service if the letters are addressed to people who are back or delinquent on their income tax? Robert Weaver, Federal Housing Commissioner, has publicly announced that in the beginning, the government gave the people control of the land. But he said the goal of the government now is to regain complete control of the use of the land. Now, I didn't read history that way. I thought the people were here first and had the land, and they formed a government. But this is now the idea. And so we see such things happening as planes equipped with surveying instruments, flying over American farms, surveying accurately from the air to determine whether the farmer has violated his planting allotment. And if he has, he's guilty as charged. No day in court, and he's fined. And if he doesn't pay the fine, his farm is seized and sold at auction. For every dollar that we were spending on the crop stabilization or the price stabilization program in the Farm Bill in 1948, we are today spending $25. And with what result? Have we reduced the problem? Well, the program is bigger, the problem is bigger. 2 million farmers have left the soil and gone to the city in search of jobs, and the debt of the American farmer in relation to income is higher than it was even on the eve of the 1929 crash. The American farmer owes $2.86 for every dollar of net income he has coming in. Our traditional laws of eminent domain recognized the occasional need for government to take private property. Only after the citizen could have a day in court, only if the government could establish first that there was a clear and present need in the public interest for this particular piece of property, and then, of course, upon the payment of a fair price. Now a variety of programs have diluted private rights so that public interest is anything a few planners decide it should be. We've adopted an urban renewal program. The original intent was to provide quickly decent homes for every American and to eliminate slums. Well, no one disagrees with that humanitarian purpose, but has this program succeeded? In a 10-year period, they've destroyed 126,000 low-rent homes. They've managed to replace them only with 28,000 dwelling units at a higher rate of rent. And more, almost a million people have been displaced by the urban renewal bulldozer and have wound up in new slums paying higher rent. The law said the displaced must be offered standard housing at rents they could afford in convenient locations. But does it take a genius to figure out that if standard housing in convenient locations at rents they could afford had been available, they'd have moved out of the slums a long time ago without waiting for urban renewal? Meantime, by contrast, while those 28,000 units were being built, the private building industry created 27 million dwelling units in that 10-year period. Now, let me make it plain. I don't challenge the sincerity of the planners. I know that they sincerely want to eliminate the problems of misery and distress and unemployment, everything that besets us. I know that all too often it's just human nature, that they honestly look at the problem and they say, if only we had a little more money, a little more power, what we could do for the people. And of course, it's also human nature for them to fail to see what might be the end result. They just want to help. It's sort of like the kid that was riding a motorcycle one day. The wind on a cold winter day was whistling through the buttonholes on his leather jacket and chilling him uncomfortably until he figured out he could turn the jacket around, put it on backward, and this wouldn't happen. Of course, it restricted his arm motions a little bit. He hit a tree, or skidded on some ice and hit a tree. And when the ambulance arrived and the attendants elbowed their way through the bystanders, one of them said, "What happened?" And the bystander said, "Well, we don't know. When we got here, he seemed to be all right. But by the time we got his head turned around straight, he was dead." Now we're to have a new cabinet post of urban affairs. And urban renewal plans will, quote, be used in a new way so that all our tools from poverty program to education and construction can be used together to create meaningful and livable communities within our cities. It sounds fine. The only catch is that someplace in a distant capital, people will make up their minds what is meaningful and livable in our community 3,000 miles away. And in other communities all over the country. We have a poverty program. Like charity, it begins at home, only in this case, home happens to be someone's bureau. They've just allotted $74,000 to Gum Springs, Virginia, $54,000 for administrator salaries and $20,000 for the poor. The mayor of Paterson, New Jersey's upset. He's just discovered that the poverty administrator's getting $1,000 a year more than he's getting. But I'm concerned, as I think all of us should be, with one particular phase of this program, the youth phase. We're going to salvage young people who, for whatever reason, have failed to meet their responsibility to fit themselves for adult life. Now, again, no one quarrels with the goal. Certainly, it is one of the noblest purposes we could have, to give every young person a fair chance at the starting line, a fair opportunity. But during this salvage operation, we're going to pay young men that we're helping and retraining a higher rate of pay than we pay the young man who puts on a uniform and goes out in the defense of his country, and there's something pretty ridiculous in that. Here in our own community, a hotel has taken over to salvage young ladies, to lift them from destitution and families of poverty, to teach them self-reliance and how to get along on their own. And the program prorates out at a cost of $7,000 a year for each young lady we're going to retrain. There are families in this country that are raising fine, productive citizens on less than $7,000 a year income for the entire family. In the dropout phase of this program, Chattanooga, Tennessee, just recently discovered their budget for the school system for educating 25,000 young people is $10 million. But the poverty program's budget for retraining some 3,300 potential and present dropouts is almost half that, almost $5 million. But the federal government says, well, of course, their budget includes $1.25 an hour for payment of work time to these potential dropouts, because one of the causes of dropout is the need to earn money while they're being educated. So they'll get $40 a week for 32 hours work while they're being retrained. But the legitimate student who has a part-time job can't make over $18.75 a week. And thus they've created an inducement for the legitimate student to drop out and become a retrainee so that he can get double his income and at the same time get his education. The network of rules grows more minute. Down in the Mason-Dixon line, to switch to another area, there's an oil station on a highway where a lot of northern tourists pass vacationing in the south. And you know that triangle of ground you so often find between the driveways and the sidewalks in an oil station, most of them cover it with gravel. Well, the operator of this oil station is pretty enterprising. He's planted a few cotton bushes. And whenever a northern tourist comes in for gas, he picks a cotton bowl and gives them a souvenir of their trip to the south, a cotton bowl picked off a cotton bush. The federal government has just fined him for planting cotton without an allotment. This morning the paper told us that a program was adopted at the federal level to subsidize art and literature. We're going to have two czars now, empowered to grant millions of dollars, some $20 million, on the basis of their opinion of what constitutes meaningful art and literature. Now, maybe I'm unduly concerned about this, but if they follow the same pattern we've seen in so much of government-subsidized scientific research, there is reason for concern. I'm not a scientist. I don't set myself up as an expert. Perhaps I'm talking out of turn. But sometimes I wonder if we aren't just subsidizing intellectual curiosity when we see tens of thousands of dollars spent on such things as research in philology and faunal affinities of fossil bryozoa in the Middle Ordovician through Silurian. Now, the only thing I understand there is that phrase, in the middle. There I know who they're talking about. But the government knows no limit to its interests. The federal government is now concerned with recreational facilities and our ability to enjoy ourselves in the great outdoors. They've just published a new booklet, 134 pages of profundities. You wonder how we got along without it up till now. For example, do you know that if you lay out a campsite, you should provide a drinking fountain at such a height that drinking level is convenient for the person using the fountain? But wait till you get to the exciting chapters on wildlife. Insects crawling into the ears of outdoorsmen sometimes create painful conditions. I got news for them. It's no fun if it happens indoors. But that isn't all they have to say about wildlife. If your recreational area has a bathhouse intended for the use of both men and women, it should be divided into two parts by a tight partition. Now, you know we'd have never thought of that one by ourselves. Our government spends $260 million a day, $10 million a day more than we were spending just a year ago. And our federal government is responsible for a planned and deliberate inflation. They tell us the only way we can maintain our prosperity is to erode the purchasing power of the dollar by 1.5 to 2 cents a year. In the last 3 decades, the dollar has gone down to 35.5 cents in purchasing power. Perhaps they just fail to remind us that while dollars in salary and income may keep pace with this inflation and this increase in price that goes along with this 1.5-2% decline, they fail to remind us of what happens to those who are trying to plan for their future, putting away dollars toward the day when they will retire on a fixed income that cannot keep pace with inflation. In the last 20 years, this inflation has eroded the value of our savings and insurance by $190 billion. My father used to say when I was a kid, the country needed a good 5-cent cigar. What this country needs now is a good 5-cent nickel. We've been told over the years, in the last several years, that we've managed to keep our federal budget, the administrative budget, under the magic $100 billion mark. But somehow there are some bookkeeping tricks involved, bookkeeping tricks which would jail a private citizen if he tried them, because every year the budget message contains a request for obligational spending authority in excess of $100 billion. We were told at the end of the last fiscal year that the deficit was smaller than we'd anticipated, that we only had a deficit of $3.5 billion. And yet on that same day, the Treasury Department announced on the financial pages that the debt had increased that same year by $7 billion. Perhaps figures don't lie, but perhaps someone lies about figures. Our gold reserve is down. I would not go so far as to say that the gold reserve and foreign aid are tied together, nor would I be so irresponsible as to suggest that we should completely pull the rug out from under those people dependent on us and cancel out this program of aid. But certainly some review is needed. We see ink spattered on American embassies in Hate America campaigns, and it's a little uncomfortable to know that we bought the ink. Incidentally, while that happens, in so many of the police states, we go along with the hypocrisy of pretending that there could be a spontaneous uprising or demonstration in these police states. And our State Department sends a note each time to the government saying, next time send more police. I think a lot of us would have more self-respect if just once the State Department would send a note that said, next time send a smaller mob. There are 325,000 dependents of civilian employees living abroad, adding to the outflow of our gold, but businessmen are asked to do a 180-degree turn and forsake their traditional role of trading in the world marketplace. I say they're asked, but under such terms as guidelines, we have an uncomfortable feeling that we're being told anymore, do or else. We're told that we've had a tax cut, going to have another one in the excise tax. And yet as we pay our tax bill, we have an uncomfortable feeling that there hasn't been so much a cut as a rearranging of the tax and just applying it someplace else. As we continue a tax policy that's based on the idea that we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. Well, you and I had better wake up. We're robbing Paul to pay Paul, and all of us are named Paul. Peter went bankrupt a long time ago. We're taxed in our food and our drink and our shelter, with the government taking a higher percentage from the free economy than any society has ever taken without ruin. People pay taxes. To pretend that you can cut the taxes without reducing the burden that causes them is to perpetrate a fraud upon the people. Whether we like to admit it or not, government is like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. In recent years, our federal government has tended to dry up the sources of revenue at the local level, the community level, and the state level. And in spite of this, We have managed at the local and state level to keep in existence and to progress with the finest public school system the world has ever known. We have in the last 10 years increased our school revenues at the local level 156%. In the last election, we adopted the highest program of school bonds that we have ever appropriated. We have built $30 billion worth of classrooms in the last 10 years. We've reduced the ratio of pupil to teacher and pupil to classroom, and we've raised teachers' salaries an average of 65%. And yet today we find the federal government in almost an hysterical atmosphere of crisis and emergency, telling us that our school system faces ruin unless we resort to massive federal injections of federal money. Well, some educators, concerned with the threat to academic freedom that is inherent in these federal handouts, have gone to Washington protesting that what problems we may have at that level could be solved perhaps if the federal government would adopt well-thought-out programs which these educators have taken to Washington, suggesting methods whereby the federal government can earmark tax funds and leave them at the local and state level without creating a new bureaucracy, without sending them back to us from Washington, complete with red tape and control on the purse strings. They argued, this one group numbering some of the most distinguished college presidents in our land, argued with officials in Washington and kept asking over and over again, why wouldn't this plan we've suggested work? And finally, a Freudian slip occurred. Francis Keppel, United States Director of Education, said, you don't understand. Under your system, we couldn't achieve our social objectives. Social objectives. Now we've just uncovered a memo by Ben Holman, head of the Media Relations Office of the Community Relations Service. A memo that reads, and they have nothing to do with education whatsoever, but this memo says, once the educational and informational campaign is solidly underway, we should conduct a systematic effort to contact all publishers and school boards to encourage their publication and adoption of textbooks conforming to established standards. Education, if we're going to let the federal government build the schools, buy the books, may grant scholarships, make judgments, and exert pressure, what if one day that pressure is of a political nature not to our liking? Education is the bulwark of freedom. But you remove it too far from the parents and the community control, and education becomes the tool of tyranny. Now, if we're men of goodwill, isn't it time for the conservative to explain the extent to which he does believe society is responsible for seeking an end to misery, poverty, disease, ignorance, and the problems of old age? But by the same token, shouldn't the so-called liberal state just how far he intends to go in regimenting society in an effort to achieve the same purpose? And if he really means the welfare state at any price, then doesn't honesty demand that he spell out completely and in advance the eventual blueprint and let us make a decision at the polls as to whether this is the system we want in our nation? Instead of putting it over on us piecemeal by foot-in-the-door legislation, pretending each time that each little measure is all that he seeks, and then gradually down through the years expanding it until eventually we find freedom eroded. Now, one reason those of you who are in business can no longer afford to stay aloof from this struggle and stay out of politics is because you just plain can't afford to. You spend a great deal of time and effort in almost every business seeking to improve your profit ratio by even a fraction of a percent. And then along comes a change in a tax law, a change in a regulation, a licensing change, a zoning change, any one of 100 things performed at government level, and wipes out all the savings that you've accomplished. Mismanagement is as costly to government as it is to private industry. The only trouble is the private citizen pays for government goofs. What can we do? Well, actually, there should be 1,000 wars on poverty. Maybe we have been negligent at the private level. Maybe we haven't communicated enough to find that someplace in this country at the private level, there has been found a solution for every problem that besets us. Some industries, faced with layoffs of their personnel because of automation, have already embarked on retraining programs fitting those men for jobs in some of the growth industries so that they won't go into unemployment but can literally transfer to another type of work. In Bedford, Ohio, they've had a dropout program for years that has reduced the dropout factor to almost a negligible percent with the cooperation of the private businessmen in that community and the educators. In Portland, Oregon, 300 business concerns and private citizens have had a program for years of retraining these so-called young people who are on the road to failure. And they have almost 100% record of success. And they have another record of success they had never counted on. Almost without exception, the young people that they help end up, once they're earning and out of school, repaying the cost of all that went into their salvage operation so that the program can continue for other young people. Daniel Webster said, "Nothing will ruin the country if the people themselves will undertake its safety. And nothing can save it if they leave that safety in any hands but their own." You and I have to be willing to study the issues, to be aware, to convey the information to family and friends. Yes, to be a pest if necessary at the social dinner table. We have to resist the temptation to get a government handout for our community while we're writing letters to our congressman urging a cut in taxes. We have to realize that the doctor's fight against socialized medicine is our fight, because if you can socialize the doctor, you socialize the patient. That government's assault on investor-owned utilities is eventually an assault on every investor-owned business. We have to demand an end to deficit spending, not only to put an end to this ruinous inflation, but because as of this moment, there is no security any place in the free world if there is not fiscal and economic stability within the United States. We are faced with an evil enemy, and in all of history, every time a cultured, advanced society has meant the less cultured, the barbarian has triumphed. Is man born with certain unalienable rights, or does he exist only by permission of and for the sake of the group? It's time we had an answer to the present high-sounding phrase, so current, so much in use, the greatest good for the greatest number. Yes, it does sound fine at first reading, but analyze it. And if you subscribe to it, it says 50% of the people plus one can do anything they please to the rest of the people. This was the greatness of our Constitution, that it took certain rights that we have and said these rights are not subject to vote. They can never be subjected to majority rule. They are ours by birth and through grace of God. If we forget that, we may well march toward eternity as the soulless freaks of nature the communist would have us believe we are, in a super ant heap. Either the power of society is limited or it is not. We can't have it both ways. History tells us that when the freedom the Athenians wished for most was freedom from responsibility, then Athens ceased to be free and was never free again. Freedom only comes to a nation and a people once, and once lost, it's never regained. So I think you and I have come to a moment of truth. 200 years ago, we lighted a torch. It said to the downtrodden of all the world that here in this land, for the first time in all history, we had created a social structure in which all men pledged their collective strength, not for the majority, but to protect the individual rights, the basic freedom of even the least individual among them. If that torch goes out, the darkness will destroy the golden hope of mankind for generations to come. And if you and I are unwilling to meet our challenge and meet it as of now, then we'd better prepare what it is we'll say to our children, what we'll tell them that we found was more precious than freedom, because I'm sure they'll want to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Ronald Reagan. You've painted rather a frightening picture, but you've also given us a great deal of hope. And that hope can only be realized if men like you can be put in positions of leadership to implement the things that you hold out as being necessary for us to accomplish the preservation of our freedom. It's nice to have people like you in public life. We'd like to have you a little farther in public life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gene. And Ronald, we have a little token for you today that we extend to our visiting speakers, and I'd like to offer you this little book on our behalf.
Well, thank you.
Thank you again, Ronald.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.